Rosa is the Deputy CEO and Managing Partner of ILS Investment Manager Leadenhall Capital Partners. And Leadenhall Capital Partners was founded in 2008. You joined the firm 2 years later. And so over 13 years, initially leading all business development and investor relations, and now becoming Deputy CEO as of last year. Prior to Leadenhall, Lorenzo spent 5 years with Aon, focused on ILS origination, structuring and sales, before which he worked at a bank and also in reinsurance broking as well. So he's got a track record in ILS investing and reinsurance, and given Leadenhall's strategy as a diversified asset manager, is perfect for this discussion today. And I wanted someone who could explain the opportunity of being a diversified and global manager within ILS while also discussing the opportunity for investors and giving a view on the marketplace as well. And so Lorenzo really is the perfect person to have up here today. So to begin, perhaps you could talk a little bit about the Leadenhall structure, background, and the key partnerships that you have in place.
Okay. Well, thank you, Steve, and good morning, everyone. And thank you, Mr. Lean, for the introductory speech. Actually, it was really good. And it's great to see how the market has evolved, you know, over the last few years in Asia. And it's actually amazing to see, you know, how many steps we've done, you know, to increase the awareness for ILS in this part of the world. Now, regarding Leadenhall, as Steve mentioned, I've been working at Leadenhall for many years now, and we've been very, I would say, very lucky at the beginning to find the right partner to start our venture in Amlin. Amlin at the time was a FTSE 250 floated company. We immediately identified the need to team up with an insurance company. You know, the question that myself, our chairman, and our CEO had at the time was, you know, can you compete with the big elephant from the insurance company in this world when you want to transfer risk from the traditional insurance market to the capital markets if you don't team up with an insurance company? I mean, obviously, insurance companies have way more resources than single ILS managers. And today is obvious, but I can assure you that back in 2007 it was not that obvious. Now, Amlin is owned by MSA&D and Mitsui Sumitomo Insurance. Obviously, we are extremely grateful for the partnership. It's extremely helpful. It's helpful from a governance standpoint. It gives investors a lot of confidence about the fact that we have a solid partner. And most importantly, it gave us the chance to always keep an eye on the various opportunities that are available in the insurance market when we think about also what's going on outside of property cat. Now, in terms of the structure, we, you know, why we thought about immediately teaming up with an insurance company, we immediately identified that it was, in order to grant access to investors in the most efficient way, the access to the balance sheet was immediately important. And now, again, today is obvious, you know, there are different types of fronting arrangements, but now we are very well positioned to basically access three different balance sheets, two through MS Amlin, which are in Lloyd's and in Europe, and another one from Nectaris Re, which is a single A rated from AM Best insurance structure that we backed up in Bermuda. You know, overall, obviously we're very pleased also by the fact that, you know, Steve mentioned the word diversified ILS managers. We actually offer 18 different strategies, which it's a lot. I'm still in charge of business development and fundraising. So as you can imagine, I guess the good news is that you always have something to sell. You know, even when you have the wind that is blowing, you can find a product that can help. And in this case, we are not very active in non-life, mainly property cat, but also in life and alternative credit. So I think that's really a big advantage also because when you talk to investors, especially the big investors, they, you know, one of the questions that you get is, but how scalable is this business? You know, if we want to enter this market, we want to put at work at least $500 million, $1 billion, but how long it's going to take you to just build a portfolio which is only dedicated to non-life property cat. And that's when you can discuss how you can actually also diversify and add a bit of specialty and also life, for example. So that's pretty powerful.
Absolutely, and actually you hit on exactly why I wanted to sort of have this fireside chat with you today, which was really to get across the point of diversification within ILS, because often we do spend far too much time talking about property cat, and as important as that is, there is other options out there for investors, and that's really one way we help to grow the marketplace, I think. So you've talked about what you offer to investors, but perhaps a little more detail just on the specific strategies within, say, non-life and then within life as well.
Sure. So the regarding non-life, it's pretty important to be able to offer capacity across the entire risk tower, right? So and that has been the aim. We started with a couple of funds, one more diversified and more, let's say, out of the money or in the more senior layers. And another fund that was that is riskier, closer to the retention, but not that close. I mean, we have certain limits, that basically prevent our portfolio managers or underwriters to go below the 15% attachment probability. Then over time, we realized that it was important to better serve not just our investors, but also our cedants, counterparties. And we said, well, we should launch a couple of other funds, one that we call Remote Risk Fund, which plays at around 1 to 2% expected loss, and another one in between the diversified and the value fund, which is about 3.5% expected loss. Now, the idea of the Remote Risk Fund a few years ago was a bit of a challenge. When you target, especially in a cycle when premiums are softening, when you target a 1% expected loss to 1.5% expected loss, it means that your return or yield that you can deliver is only around 3%. Now, these days, actually, it's much easier because, as we heard many, many times, yields are much higher, so we can actually deliver way more than, when we launch the fund. Now, why it was important to launch the Remote Risk Fund? Simply because when you think about the classic traditional reinsurance model, any rated counterparty that is providing reinsurance to the cedants will always target the riskier layers because they have to make sure that they deliver a return on equity to their shareholders, and for them that's where is the most efficient use for their capital. But then we all know, because we've all been working in this industry for a long time, that insurance companies really also like reinsurers to provide capacity for the very senior layers, because that's where the regulator and the rating agencies will basically provide them with capital efficiency. And so in order to become more relevant to our counterparties, then it was important for us from a strategic standpoint to also offer something which is less risky, more out of the money. And then thinking about life, life is a big market, and it's a multiple in terms of the non-life, and there are so many different plays you can have, and of course there is always this connotation of ILS should always deliver lowly correlated returns, if not uncorrelated. Now, uncorrelated, I see some of my peers use it a lot. I mean, it's always a challenge to use the word uncorrelated, but let's say lowly correlated. But then when we talk about life, we can't discuss about uncorrelated or lowly correlated, but we can discuss about diversifiers. Obviously life is way more sensitive to macro shocks, especially when you think about, for example, pandemic or lapse risk, mortality risk. And there are, as I said, depending on the investors, you can target the low returns what we deem to be low risk, which was pre-COVID, the pandemic. But let's not forget that when you cover life, you cover the working population, and COVID mostly affected the elderly, unfortunately. So we did suffer some volatility, of course, but nothing major. But then the returns that you can make for the life mortality type of business is quite low. I mean, pre-pandemic, it was around probably 3% yield. Today is about probably 3 to 4, We've been trying hard to push it to 5. Obviously, we receive a lot of inquiries, especially from the broking firm, saying, you know, if you want pandemic risk, then we can transfer it. And we keep saying yes, but we should earn more. It's pretty clear because after COVID, you know, it is a risk. You know, before COVID, no one was expecting it, right? So it was a really, really remote event, but actually it's something that is real. And then we actually rebranded our life team from life to life, an alternative credit team. And the reason for that is that you can then also talk to other type of investors that want to take more risk because they have appetite for higher yield. And we have to remember that at the end of the day, every time that we are out there discussing about what we are offering, we are judged on a relative value basis, right? So it's not just because we offer ILS that there should be some space within their investment buckets. It's all about what else is out there that they could invest in compared to what we're offering. So sometimes if you go to an investor and talk about mortality and pandemic offering 3%, they're really not interested. I mean, especially in this part of the world. I mean, I just discovered that there are 1,000 family offices from Mr. Lim, so we're gonna be very busy here if we manage to meet them all. We should try to invite all of them, right, to these conferences in the future. But, you know, in this part of the world, if you promise 3 to 4, I mean, they just don't even open the door to you, right? And but then you can do other type of structures. Obviously, I mean, most of you are probably familiar with life embedded value or life in force securitization. So the ability to basically lend against expected future cash flows. Now, one thing we keep telling investors is even if there is a perception of security associated to the fact that there are cash flows there, please remember there is always credit risk and, most importantly, regulatory risk. There is a big difference between cash flows that have been earned in the past and are segregated in the trust account and cash flows that are still to be earned. And if anything goes wrong, the regulator could always intervene and size those assets. So especially now, where the level of interest rates is pretty high and the ability to provide funding is very low, we are already witnessing a number of life insurance companies being under stress, especially the startups, the small and medium sized in the US that always rely on refinancing. And that's not just insurance, right? This is across all sectors. I mean, it's just happening. And obviously, we have to keep an eye and say, okay, if you want to target a return which is almost double digit, there are opportunities there, but obviously there is credit risk, there is regulatory risk, and it's not just lapse, mortality, or pandemic. So, but it's a very interesting area, and there is a lot of work to be done as well in the life space, and we have also been looking at a lot of opportunities in Asia, of course. I mean, after U.S., Japan is the biggest life insurance market, and also, you know, as you can imagine, as a company, we've been through a lot of volatility during 17 and 18 on property cat. So at least I had something to talk about, apart from reassuring the property cat investor that things will improve. We could also sell something on the life side, but now, I mean, we are in such attractive market that. You know, with property cut is definitely back into fashion.
Absolutely, thank you, Lorenzo. So, different time in terms of property cat, definitely. And you mentioned your remote risk, and it made me think it's an interesting time in the insurance market in terms of we're hearing about players pulling away from frequency and severity in a lot of cases in places like California and Florida as well. It makes reinsurance capital incredibly important at both top and bottom level. But do you think the opportunities perhaps at the upper layers at the moment?
Yeah, that's a good question. We should have called this the wildfire chat rather than the fire chat. Yes, Steve, it's interesting. I mean, obviously, I meet investors from globally, right, for all different regions, and it's always interesting that even if, and I agree with you, right? I mean, even if we structure our funds to stay away if we can from the frequency, and even if we are now in incredibly attractive market conditions where not just us, but all our peers are focusing more on per occurrence, less on aggregate type of triggers, then we are all extremely excited by the fact that terms and conditions are much tighter, perils are better defined, also triggers are better defined. And so theoretically we could claim that all our portfolios are much cleaner in a way than how they looked like in 2017, where we had to stop and close the funds in 18, actually after 17, because too much money was coming in, right? And so the lessons learned, apart from obviously our underwriting approach, has also been maybe when we talk to investors, we should again remind them about, and by the way, it's not just reminding them, it's, the first question is always climate change and what it means, and the difference between secondary peril and primary peril, and then when you look at some numbers, you immediately realize that the cumulative losses from secondary perils over the last 20 years have been over $1 trillion compared to the secondary perils that has been around $900 billion, but obviously very different type of shape in terms of the curve. You know, you look at the secondary perils and it's a smooth log normal or exponential curve that shows that actually there is a lot of frequency, right? Whereas in the primary perils you have these jumps. And why? Simply because the primary perils obviously cause losses or industry losses that are a multiple in size compared to the secondary perils. And so when you talk to investors, you know, you remind them that especially in these market conditions where yields are at historical high level, there is a lot that you can gain also by staying out of the money. And you keep discussing it until the investor then tells you, well, but maybe I should still target my 15% because it's a small percentage of my portfolio and it's a strong diversifier. But then, again, depends on where you are in the world, right? I mean, it's... but I agree with you that maybe to get the market slightly more stable and gain more traction on the private placements, obviously on the carbons, we all had a great run so far this year. But for the private placements, it would be good maybe to target, you know, lower risk layers where, as you hinted at, you know, you have less a probability of getting hit from the secondary perils because you are more out of the money, even if maybe the wording covers them, and deliver more stable returns. But you know, we'll see how, you know, things develop and how. Ultimately, the good news is that we have a lot of strategies. So then, you know, as far as you are transparent and explain what the risks are, then is the investor call.
And there still seems to be some appetite for some of the riskier layers and among the investor base as well. And obviously, it's really important that that capital is there to keep the insurance market functional. So, time's rattling on, actually. So, let's move on to the current state of the market. And so, you mentioned there about Catalan's obviously having a very good year.
Yeah.
What's your sort of outlook on the private side in non-life and then also for the life market?
Yeah, so on the private side, I think we are all pushing hard to get more capital in, and it's probably fair to say that most of the investors want to see a quiet year. So we'll probably all celebrate if the wind doesn't blow this year. Now, touch wood, if there is any wood around here. But we do need, you know, we've been saying this for the last 5 years. But you know, again, I'm positive. I see the world of investors is huge. Obviously, again, with this, just in this part of the world, there are a lot of people that are not even familiar with what we do. So there is a big element of training. Actually, very pleased again that Mr. Lim mentioned that they're doing also a lot of work to increase the awareness locally. Thank you for that. Very much appreciated. And it's the same for other countries, right? Unfortunately, there are some countries in Asia, like Japan, where you know, private placements still are not flying anymore. They really want to see the market back. But the good news, I think, is that transparency across the board has increased a lot. I mean, when you have these events and when you have investors that get hit by those events, then everyone, and I mean us and all our peers, realize that it's very important from the very first meeting to discuss about the gray areas of the asset class, right? Which I've been saying for many years now. I say every time you meet someone, an investor, first meeting, please discuss collateral trapping, the use of side pockets, how, you know, what happens once there is an event, how long it's going to take for claims to develop. It's much better to be honest and transparent from the very beginning and then get the tricky questions, and then after the event is an easier conversation. That's really what helped us as a firm to remain stable in our AUM and keep growing. So no one, you know, was disappointed because it wasn't told something. But now I can see that when I mention, if some of my peers have been meeting this investor before me, and they mention it, and they say, "Oh yes, we heard about it," which actually didn't occur until 2017. So that I think is really, really good for the market.
Absolutely, I think one of the key things this year is that there are just less surprises for people, even if the wind does blow. I think more predictability and more evidence of both high returns, but also the work that's been done on the structure
in
recent years. So if we sort of look to the future and you think about what are you seeing that encourages you in ILS at the moment?
Well, a lot of things, right? I mean, we can stay here probably a couple of hours on that point. But I think we cover it, right? I mean, the market has never been so attractive. The investors' interest must, you know, increase over time, especially if we have a quiet year in terms of events. And transparency is definitely one. Efficiency on the structures is another one. So every ILS manager now is able to basically grant access to the asset class in a very efficient way through different balance sheets. You know, there is ability to see the tail risk if an investor wants. There is an ability to do collateral overlay. So the market is way more sophisticated and flexible and can adapt to any type of investors around the world. So I think that's really good for the industry. And the demand for insurance is increasing a lot. Okay, again, we heard from Mr. Lim about the Asia, and you know, the protection gap is a big issue, but we're all here to narrow it. And obviously, by having a higher penetration of insurance, then there is going to be more demand. If there is no more demand, then the market is going to be more efficient and more disciplined, because as we know, premiums are always dependent on supply and demand of capital. So I think, you know, overall, we are in a fantastic, you know, position to actually do well.
Yeah, I think it's good you mentioned the protection gap, because it appears to be becoming a bit of an insurability gap as well in the developed world, developed markets. So the gap appears to be expanding along with inflation at the moment. So given where we sit here in Singapore today, perhaps a few comments on sort of what you're seeing on the Asian ILS investor base. I know you've been travelling around the region again before this event. How is ILS being received at the moment, and what are people asking you as well?
Well, every ILS manager these days is probably opening every meeting by showing the track record on their carbon fund, right? Because we never had such a good year, I think, since I remember, you know, being involved in this industry. Maybe after Lehman Brothers, actually, we did very well. Of course, a lot of bonds were trading below par, and we all delivered double-digit returns, right? But then, that's usually the opening, and which brings actually another point, which is encouraging, the discussion about the liquidity of the market, right? And the fact that carbons have been able to actually deliver through the turmoil last year. You know, as soon as inflation started to pick up and the interest rates started to go up, we started seeing some of the UK pension funds, for example, that then went through this LDI crisis, redeeming, and we were able to actually deal very efficiently with the liquidity of our fund. And so liquidity and cap bonds are in this part of the world, especially for the wealth money managers and family offices, are definitely the focus. And that's then the excuse to discuss about the private placements. I must say, we would love to see the big institutional guys to move quicker. Some of them that are already invested obviously got slightly burned in the past, so again, they're taking a break. But I mean, the more we travel, the more we meet with them, and hopefully if the market support us with returns, then I don't see any reason why, you know, they should also come in. That's for sure.
And what about Asia as a source of risk? I mean, you mentioned on the life side, obviously Japan, but then on the non-life side, on the private side, it's more difficult. Where are you seeing sort of progress?
Again, I think the progress is there. I mean, again, Mr. Lee made an amazing summary of all these issues, you know, in the region. Obviously, we are extremely proud of MS Amlin that we find as advisors, you know, sponsor for the third time a sidecar called Phoenix for ILS managers, which is a great example of the possibility for transferring Asian risk to the capital markets. We've seen the IBRD and the World Bank, and again, I'm a great supporter of the World Bank, and every time I can, I'm very happy to help them where possible to increase the awareness of what they're doing. And the one obvious hurdle, which again was raised earlier, is the modeling. There's a lot of efforts that are being made to develop the models here. I think the real challenge is the quantification of the risk, right? But that's also where collaborations between ILS managers and insurers can really help to bridge that gap. So again, we do a lot of work with Mitsui Sumitomo. Amin has an office here and trying to understand better the perils. There is an element of research. Ultimately, it's all down to are you rewarded enough for the risk that you're taking. Then, no doubt, you know, anything that is deemed as a diversifier help your portfolio. So if you are comfortable as an investor that you are paid for the risk that you're taking, and you can demonstrate to your investors that actually you're not just taking a bet, but you understand what you're doing on your underwriting side, then you know Asian risk is always welcome. And we've seen from the stats, I mean, penetration is increasing, which is great. We expect you know 10 to 15% compounding growth every year, which is all music to my ears.
Absolutely. I mean, the ILS market certainly needs diversification, and investors do appreciate it. So. Running very low on time now. Do you have a vision for the future of a company like Leadenhall and the role that Asia might play in the future of your business?
Well, maybe more than a vision, I have a lot of hopes, I think, like everyone else.
Absolutely.
Yes. It's like, because it's amazing how you have to readjust quickly as a... Obviously, we are a big ILS manager, but we're still a small institution, right, if you think in the context of the financial markets. And we constantly discuss strategic initiatives, and we try to predict, you know, what is the next. And it's always interesting to see that, you know, you can basically come out with different ideas, but then my question mark is always, do you really want to test a new initiatives with your investors' money? I think that's really the question mark, right? And I know that different ILS managers have completely different views, right? And it's great. I mean, I love innovation, and it's great to see that you know, we have cyber cover to come into the market, that there are others that are pushing long tail, for example, type of initiatives, casualty, securitization, and so on. You know what, our background as a team was on the structuring and origination side. So already 15, 20 years ago, we were, you know, working on motor securitization and trying to understand what are the hurdles for the investors. And sometimes I'm worried and I'm thinking, okay, I really hope everything goes well, because obviously property cat has already delivered a few headaches. We're now trying to explain to investors what the lessons learned are, investors seek diversification, so of course there are investors that are happy to jump on anything that is get offered, but at least personally, as Ledenol, I think we have a lot to learn about all these new perils, or you know, perils that have been there for a while, but that investors have not been tested about taking it. And so we go slowly, and we just hope that in the meantime, you know, we can be profitable for them with what we're doing, which 18 strategies are already a lot. So
absolutely. No need to add a casualty fund quite yet.
Quite yet, yeah. Maybe on specialty also is something that everyone likes. We like it, but maybe casualty.
I think it's good. I think there's a lot of predictions for some of these new powers to grow very quickly in some quarters, but I think a steady approach is probably the most sensible.
But it's, I mean, I think the great news is that, I mean, the other day I was talking to an investor, and he told me, we research 20 managers. I was like, wow, I didn't even realize you can research 20 managers, right? And then you hear from them and say, you're all different, right? I think that's the beauty of the industry. I mean, we all try to deliver something, and we all have different views, and which makes it sometimes complex for the investors, because you know, they keep scratching their head and say, okay, so what shall I do here? Because there are so many different angles. But at the same time, it keeps all busy and passionate, and we all like each other, which is amazing if you think about this sector, right? So, which is great. I mean, it's, we all have fun as well, which is also important.
Which is very good to see.
Yeah, absolutely.
Variety is the spice of life.
Absolutely.
Lorenzo Volpi, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Steve.
Appreciate your time today.
No, thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Please put your hands together.